Okay, this is it. Today is the day. For the first time in my life, I'm going to make a truly original artistic statement. Because, yes, I realize that everything I've ever done, everything is completely derivative, is nothing more than a simmering ragu of my major influences, which would be, in no particular order, Married with Children, Led Zeppelin, the movie Clue, Sally Ride, Emo Phillips, Wilson Phillips, Philip Seymour Hoffman, John Philip Sousa, Philip Screwdrivers, Gina Davis. Oh, Gina Davis. Hi, Gina. It's me. You never answered any of my... Never mind. Neil deGrasse Tyson, Weird Al Yankovic, Meryl Shoes, The Punch Brothers, anything Emily Haynes ever did. Anyway, forget all of it. I'm just going to sit here in this room until I have a thought which is completely original, which does not have so much as a Vibram enclosed toe on the shoulders of those giants who came before me. Okay, here I go. All I could think of was three girls singing harmony and playing Clue, and one of them was kind of overweight, and they all looked like Neil deGrasse Tyson. I'm a fraud. Okay, I'm nothing. I will never be original. Although, come to think of it, did any of them ever say those specific things that they were, you know, nothing? I could be on to something really fresh and new. Today on The Nose, our panel will talk about Rush Limbaugh, Conan O'Brien, a controversial punter, Subarus and lesbians, and a restaurant critic who's letting the world see what he looks like. And now he finally finished binge-watching the Yule Log channel, and he hated season 4. Colin McEnroe.
Or as I call it, Burning Bad. All right, so they're already grooming. They're already in rebellion against me. Usually doesn't happen until the first 15 minutes or so. All right, joining us today for The Nose, Irene Papoulis from Trinity College, where she is a professor. Jim Chaplin is a professor of music and producing and winning Emmys and stuff like that. And Tracy Wu Fastenberg, who's a professor of, well, adorableness, among other things, at the Mark Twain House. She's very pregnant right now. What's your? Can we say your due date on the air? Is that okay? Is that
April 10th.
An invasion of your privacy? Yeah. So you'll have other appearances.
Yeah, I've got a little time.
Yeah. Has the doctor told you specifically when you have to stop being on the nose? Does that come up?
Detrimental to your health.
Yeah. All right. So that's who's here. And I'll tell you a little bit about we we're always kind of churning emails out when we do this. You know, we come up with topics and then we come up with more topics. And for about 24 hours, depending on who's on the panel, you know, there's sort of a lot of back and forth discussions, a lot of clicking reply to all. Today didn't set the record. There have been other ones that have set the record. But we had a lot of discussions, I think, about this, partly because maybe there aren't any really sort of super burning news issues, but also because we got really interested in certain threads, certain things that kind of seem to make sense in conjunction with one another. So later in the show, we will tell you the story of Chris Cluey, who is the punter, was the punter for the Minnesota Vikings, got cut and has written of late a very long, very passionate essay for the website Deadspin, in which he basically says that he got cut because of his views, which include being in favor of gay marriage and opposed to some of the former practices of the Roman Catholic Church, and that the people who cut him were cowards and worse. So anyway, that's to come. But I think that sort of ties into some other issues we'll be talking about in the second segment. So if that's of interest to you, please do think about calling us then. And then prior to that, sort of for the first segment, what we're going to talk about is we're going to start with a very small controversy that doesn't mean anything, but we think, based on the discussions that we had about it online, that it could come to mean something over the course of the show. So let me also tell you where to call in, although I have to tell – I have to sort of break the fourth wall and say the computer isn't switched into this room right now, so if people call in, I won't be able to see unless somebody
– Wait a second. You use a computer?
Maybe Tucker can – wave at Tucker out there. See if you can flip the computer over. All right. So our number is 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You may tweet at us at WNPR Colin. We're having one of these days, too, where like half the people who would ordinarily work here are out for various reasons. So we're in a different configuration. My computer just came on. That was great. All right. So here we go. It all starts. I can't remember who first suggested this topic. I think it was Betsy. The topic was that Rush Limbaugh was complaining about Conan O'Brien. So you know that this is not a really major story. does anybody want to try to explain what it is that he was – I mean, I can do it, but, you know, class.
Yeah. Class. Okay, teacher. Conan O'Brien had one of those series of clips from local news in which every single local news reporter in all different kinds of places wearing all different kinds of outfits said the exact same thing. And the thing that they said was, it's okay, you can admit it if you've bought an item or two or 10
Do you want to actually hear the clip? I think we have that one. Okay, let's. We have that clip, I think.
It's okay, you can admit it if you've bought an item or two or 10 for yourself.
Well, it's okay, you can admit it if you have bought an item or two or maybe 10 for yourself.
It's okay, you can admit it. You've bought an item or two or 10 for yourself.
It's okay, you can admit it if you bought an item or two or 10 for yourself.
It's okay, you can admit it if you bought an item or two.
You get the picture. So that was on Conan. And Rush said what?
Rush said, wait a minute, he's using a technique that I invented back when Cheney was chosen to be the vice president for George Bush, because everyone was using the word gravitas to describe Cheney, and I had the clips of lots of people using the word gravitas, so I invented it.
We can also show you that. Let's hear a little gravitas.
His weaknesses, lack of gravitas.
We see the son, who is seeking some gravitas.
They were looking at candidates with gravitas.
But he has the gravitas. You can sum it up in one word, stature.
It may go to the gravitas.
Or to use the favorite phrase, gravitas.
This is a vice president.
Well, you get the idea.
Stature was in there,
right.
too.
Yeah, stature. Yeah. Stature. Gives a little break. Yeah. So, I mean, nobody invented this, right? I mean,
I don't think so. I actually Googled gravitas, and it came into popular use in 1869. But before we start, I have to say to Kayon, look who thinks she's nothing. You know, come on. That we've all thought we're nothing.
Oh, so you don't even think that was an original idea.
Yeah, come on. No, that was a great open. So, it's been in common use, and that leads us to what's original, but we maybe want to get there after we unpack this little Rush thing a little bit more. Rush really even come up with anything original, or is he just pandering all the time or repackaging stuff all the time?
Well, significantly, the one person that Rush will admit to having ever imitated, Larry Lujack, a DJ, a sort of Midwestern Chicago-based DJ, died a couple weeks ago. So it was in the New York Times right around Christmas time.
And Bob Grant.
And Bob Grant, who Rush probably did imitate, whether he would admit it or not, also died. I don't know exactly what that has to do with anything, but it ties in somehow. No, I to me, one of the interesting things about this is that that Larry Lujack, who Rush did claim to have emulated and perhaps imitated and stuff like that, was not really interested in having that credit on his agenda. He actually sort of said, well, I don't really see his appeal, and I don't really see what he's got to do with me. And to me, that's the worst insult. Not not you ripped me off, but – you claim you ripped me off, and I would prefer not to be associated with you. I don't want the credit of your imitation. But it did. I mean, as we were sort of sharing emails about this, one of the things that I said – well, actually, let me go back to Irene for a second, because one of the things that you said was that forget about Rush for a second. This is something that everybody kind of does,
well,
right?
Actually, yeah, and I got to that by saying, you know, yes, it's easy to sort of make fun of Rush, but then I start to sort of sympathize with him in a way with that feeling of – wait a minute, you're doing something I did and I'm not getting any credit for the fact that you're doing it. And this is something that I kind of invented, you know, and we sort of have, and then it just got me thinking about the ways in which I have certain things, you know, like I was thinking sometimes when you use a word, you know, you use a word in conversation and then somebody else uses the exact same word as though they just thought of it out of the blue. And you're thinking, wait a minute, I'm the one that used the word conflate the first time or whatever, you know, in this particular conversation. Or I'm the one that wore those, you know, I have these, you know, certain kind of earrings that I used to wear every single day. And then I saw one of my colleagues wearing them. And I thought, hey, wait a minute, those are mine. That's mine. You know, and
so far, this is a great Rush impersonation. You've got to take that on the road.
It's sort of an Elaine Venice impersonation, yeah. I think. I can see this as an Elaine rant on Seinfeld.
Right.
I am the conflate person. Right. You're saying
yours
is. That was my word.
You're verisimilitude. You've always been verisimilitude.
Well, anyway, I fired back at Irene with sort of the typical thing that people say, which is, you know, that nobody has any original ideas, that the very, very 99.999% of what we do is, in fact, in all the ways suggested by Wolfie's intro, just built on or on the work of other people, on at minimum a fusion or transmogrification of a bunch of other ideas that came before, because there just aren't that many really original ideas. And when they occur, they bug us anyway because they're too original, which then depressed Tracy. So I'll let you pick up the story.
Well, you had asked us each to, you know, can we each come up with something that's truly original? And being the little overachieving student, I'm sitting there thinking. And of course,
never ask an Asian person to do something like that. It's so,
exactly.
It's going to drive them crazy.
It's going to get us all in trouble. You know, and I was thinking, and everything I could think of seemed to be derivative of something else. You know, you think of something that was really sort of revolutionary for its time, but it all evolved from something else that predecessed it. And that's sort of depressing, you know. Or even I was trying to think of some of my friends who are amazing artists or, you know, creators or whatnot. And you know what? They all have their influences that they would admit to and proudly say, you know, these are the people that influenced me. But so that doesn't make it truly original, which then backs it up to what is truly original. So, and that was sort of sad that I couldn't come up with a good answer.
You know what? The wheel. Start with the wheel.
Well, you know, Jim, as a musician, I think you've got a unique perspective on this. And most musicians will cop to the position that I laid out, right? Most musicians will say, if you think you're doing something really original, that just means you haven't quite figured out what it is that influenced
right.
you in the first place.
Especially right now where we're, I think, in the middle of the second great banjo scare of our days. Where folk music is being revisited but not reinvented, and there's a whole generation who there's inside Llewellyn Davis. I think every now and then in music, my discipline, there is somebody who's a game changer, whether it's Louis Armstrong or Stephen Foster or Charlie Parker, and that vocabulary they develop 50 years later is now in jingles. And we've totally absorbed whatever. In fact, it was Louis Armstrong who said of Charlie Parker, I won't attempt to imitate him, but he said, you know, this sounds like Chinese music to me.
Well, yeah, and in fact, that's Adam Gopnik, I think, had something about this in The New Yorker not too long ago, that the irony of that, too, is that you can be brilliant working on that stretch of flat water where, in fact, nothing really truly new is happening. So, and I think one of the ideas that he said was that for Duke Ellington, you know, who had really perfected a kind of big band orchestral kind of jazz music, bebop must have been an incredible slap in the face in the sense that suddenly it rendered less imaginative what he was doing. It was suddenly an original statement where he was really kind of developing something where he had built on the work of others.
Or Einstein being unable to wrap his head around quantum physics after changing the way we think.
It also might be, I mean, I'm really on thin ice here. I'm way outside my area of expertise. You could even make a similar argument, I think, the argument that you can be brilliant without having been able to grasp the next original thing that happened about Bach. You know, I mean, that really, you know, the music that came after Bach, as great as Bach was, you know, it was a kind of symphonic music that he didn't really do or write or something.
Because he was writing music on the way to the gig in his coach because he was so prolific. He was like just wailing, this is just a jingle to me, and it'd be a two-part invention.
Anyway, I don't know what I'm talking about in that instance. Send me emails telling me I don't know what I'm talking about. Go ahead.
I'm just thinking that I have had, I teach writing, and so I've had at least, I would say probably over the years, at least 10 or 15 students who've said to me, I don't want to read anything because that's going to taint my sensibility for writing. You know, I just want to write what actually comes out of me and really be original. But of course, right. You know, that's impossible. But yeah.
No words. So.
Well, I mean, it's the flaw also is, I mean, not only are they already tainted, but no one would really want to read the crap that they would write if they were that. I mean, in fact, to be a writer, to be anything represents having a tremendous amount of prior information, like a really good store of prior information. I suppose there is that occasional Tassadei tribes person who's been living alone in the jungle and comes out and starts playing some really interesting percussion or pan flute or something that nobody's ever heard before, and it's really wonderful. But for the most part, when somebody's good at something, whether it's writing or music or art or whatever, it's because they've acquired a tremendous amount a huge bank of information about what has come before that was
good. And
they've
synthesized all this into something new.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Colin, don't you feel as a writer that the thing that you want to do is to come up with something that grows out of your own unique sensibility and in some way thus is original, even along with the fact that, you know, the voices and the language and the words are received in some way. You want that point. 0.1%, right?
Oh yes, I mean I think that's true, but my quote unquote original voice is still a synthesis and a distillation of. Yeah, I mean, if I get it, if I manage to come up with something. I mean, actually, this show is a pretty interesting example in a sense that we came in here. This may be too much inside baseball, but I'll tell a little bit of the story. When I first was being interviewed to come to work here, I wasn't really a public radio person or something. There's this great guy who's not here anymore who was, I think, general manager or something at the time. And I was at a meeting with him and some other people, Mr. Dankowski. And this guy is a great guy, but he slid over to the table towards me this huge book, this big kind of loosely bound book that was like public radio best practices or something. And he said, you're really going to want to read this. and I can't remember whether I said it out loud or not, but I was thinking, there's no way I'm going to read that. And it's the last thing in the world I want to do because, I mean, you know, I'd like to try to do something a little different here. Whatever it is, the last thing I want to know is what the rules are. I think that's true. I think, you know, even I'm looking over at you because of Twain. I think with Twain, it's not that Twain started writing in a completely different language or anything like that, but he does represent a leap suddenly, a leap into vernacular, right?
Right.
I mean, you're the Twain person. I'll let you take
but
over.
But I'm nowhere near an expert. But yeah. I think because of the way that he could relate to the common man, because he had experienced so much across his lifetime, it was that relatability that really spoke to and continues to speak to people. You know, it may not have been completely original. Some of the stories that he had were things that he experienced or heard from others and that type of thing. But that's what made him so approachable for so many readers, you know, throughout generations.
But I'm absolutely convinced that I have never had an original idea, and despite a lifetime.
And you know what? I'm going to go further out on the ice with you, maybe even fall in. But maybe there's a Darwinian component that says a totally original way of thinking is contrary to your continued existence. I mean, if there's a guy who comes up with, I just invented the bow and arrow, but it fires backwards. you know, then you know, that's the end of that idea.
Maybe we should have said original good idea.
Yeah, right. So a totally original brain is not going to serve you well in the world, probably.
Well, one of the things we talked about as we were emailing back and forth about this was Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he basically once again posits the same pattern, which is long stretches of flat water, punctuated occasionally by these just eruptions, these geysers the Copernican Revolution being, I think, his favorite example. Just, you know, so that's 1,400 years of thinking about the setup of the universe one way. And it can't be done by one person. It's not just Copernicus. It's Galileo. It's Kepler. It's all these other people. That suddenly there's like a whole bunch of people who figure something out and boom, the whole thing goes off in a different direction.
And they're in jail.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. And you will usually pay some kind of a price for that. And there was this terrific documentary. I'm talking way too much. But there was this terrific documentary on this past weekend on Studio 360. It originated on WNYC about 1913, which was one of those years where everything just went nuts. It was Duchamp. It was Schoenberg. It was famously Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, where everything new happened in one year, and people freaked out. And
Picasso.
You know, and then there were riots.
Yeah.
Because people, they don't like new ideas that much. I think that's part of the other problem with new ideas. They don't like them. They don't like being told the universe isn't set up the way that they've been told, and they don't like hearing music that isn't anything.
Why
like
don't
that.
They? I mean, some people like new ideas. You know, why is it such a threat that, you know, that something's I guess it forces you to do something differently.
And it has just to change your brain, right? When you hear this stuff for the first time or see Guernica or whatever it is, it's got to mess with your head, man.
But isn't that good?
Yeah.
We like comfort. You know, we find comfort in continuity. And I think even as things evolve, we tend to feel more comfortable with those ideas because they're built on the ones that we're already comfortable with. And so it's that kind of smooth upward trajectory rather than, you know, the big old wave that comes along. And we feel toppled at that point. So I think some people are set up to just want that sort of smooth, and then there are others that are really open to that sort of shakeup and originality and are willing to be stuck in jail.
And Jim, how many hundreds of artists have you worked with who start to develop this exciting new sound, and then they, in their concerts, of course, everybody shows up at the concerts and says, I hope he plays all his hits. I hope he
plays
the
ones
that I really like.
Yeah. I think it was Sammy Davis Jr. that said, if you're going to have a hit, you better fall in love with it because you're going to sing it the rest of your life. I think there's no way to make music without a prior vocabulary unless you do play the pan flute. Who was the guy, the pan flute guy? He was so great. He was like, there was that whole...
But no one remembers him.
Yeah, no one does. Yeah, that's right. So he originaled himself right
so
out of the
amazing,
public consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah, just another thing that may or – there's so many things about this that fascinate me and that could tie into this. But I just quickly – and I don't know how well this ties in, but one of the first links I circulated and we've got an interesting call from Janet in North Haven, which I'll also take. Our number, 860-275-7266. We're talking about the whole idea, you know, are there things that people do that are strictly, truly original, that really represent kind of a vivid departure from everything else that's come before? How often does that actually happen? 860-275-7266. Well, there's, I mean, you know, back to your students who don't want to read anything because they don't, you know, they don't want to be influenced by anything. I mean, there's sort of almost a comic image of that, and it's Jonathan Franzen. You know, Jonathan Franzen famously goes through these periods where he sits blindfolded with earplugs in, and I mean, he tries to isolate himself from everything, so he'll be absolutely all alone with his thoughts.
There'll Elvis Costello else. Used to, like, I'm not going to listen to any music for a year before I write a record.
Yeah.
But he's written 40 albums now, so how can that?
And impossible. Elvis Costello stands out to me as, in some ways, a deeply original artist, but also one of the most... You know, and syncretistic isn't the right word, but was most, one of the most synthesizing
right,
artists.
Right, absolutely.
A guy who really pulls on every musical. He's an omnivore, too.
Right,
you know, more than most people. He's very aware of Rodgers and Hart, and he's very aware of punk, you know.
And Kronos Quartet.
And Kronos
whoever,
Quartet
sure.
And Sophie Otter-Muller or whatever her name is. The other point I was going to make is that, you know, the other person who's trying to do this right now in a different way or exploring this question in a different way, and then we'll get to phone calls, is Adam Platt. I circulated this link early on. Adam Platt is the food critic for New York Magazine. And so food critics, because they have a different kind of anxiety of influence, their anxiety of influence is that if they're in a restaurant and the restaurant owner knows who they are, this will no longer be a pure experience. It will be they'll be catered to in a way that they don't want to be. So you have Ruth Reichel, who, you know, famously did wear all these disguises and stuff like that to fool people. And they always leave, you know, make their reservations in names not their own. But Adam Platt finally said, hey, you know what? Everybody knows what I look like. Every restaurateur of any merit in New York City knows who I am and what I look like. I'm sure my picture's up in every kitchen. So let's dispense with all this. And he put his picture on the cover of New York Magazine, or they put his picture on the cover of New York Magazine. And what did you think of that?
I didn't like it because I think that a food critic should be anonymous. But he made an interesting case. He sort of said, well, as long as they don't know I'm coming in advance, then it's going to be the food. And if they send me some extra things, I'm just going to sort of shoo them away. But it seemed like, you know, is that his ego that wants to say, you know, he wants to be a celebrity just like anyone else or what? I mean, I didn't know of him before. So that's my first reaction.
I'd like to think that it's not self-serving like that. I'd like to think that he's sort of unwilling to play the game anymore because he does acknowledge that every restaurateur knows what his face looks like and probably some, you know, fairly often, people who dine out often may recognize him as well. You know, so he's still trying to put the parameters into place of they don't know I'm coming, that type of thing.
You review restaurants sometimes. You haven't done that in a while. But
Yeah, because there hasn't been too much new stuff that
she
comes out.
She reviews restaurants under a pseudonym, so people wouldn't even know to put
right her. Now it's probably mostly donuts. So
there's pickles. A lot of donuts involved and a lot of noodles right. involved in this.
Right.
Yeah, you can't trust the restaurant criticism of a pregnant woman.
Exactly.
Anyway. They'll eat anything.
So is there any difference, though, between this? Because isn't a chef going to now perform for him? And I can recall one time playing in Nashville, and Alison Krauss came in to see us, and I was never more nervous in my life. But the band played really good because of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably would have played pretty good anyways, I would hope, but I know I was really nervous. So does that make the chef nervous? Because the chef is doing a performance right now for this guy. So does it?
And is that good or bad?
Well, yeah. I don't think it changes the experience because he's just making sure this guy gets a good meal, unless he does some, you know, conflated thing off the menu that's off the menu.
He would have had that performance going whether this guy's face was on the cover of the magazine or not. Maybe more chefs will know now if he's going to a lesser-known restaurant or one that's not, you know, on their toes about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways this is a nice equalizer. I mean, first of all, let me just say, I remember one night going into a restaurant with Greg Morago, who was at that time reviewing restaurants for Northeast Magazine and the Hartford Current, and there were four of us or five of us there, and I was the first person to get to the table, and I watched the restaurant people, the people who ran the restaurant, ID everybody, not just Greg. They knew who every single person sitting at the table was, and kind of alluded to that. And I mean, Adam Platt is playing at a much higher level. And really, any restaurant owner of any significance in New York knows exactly what he looks like. And the people that might not be fair to would be maybe the really naive person who's just opened up this really cool, out of the box, deeply original. Just to go back to our earlier topic, you know, fusion taco place in the East Village or something. Who's the one person who doesn't know who Adam is or what he looks like and doesn't know enough to suck up to him?
So he was doing it for them.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you could at least say you're putting everybody on the same playing field. Let me grab a few calls here too. A lot of people calling in here. We'll start with Cassandra, if I can make the mouse work, we will start with Cassandra in Simsbury. There we go. Hi, Cassandra. You're on the air.
Hey, Colin. So I teach a course at CCSU called Aesthetic and Critical Dialogue about Art. And my students frequently have difficulty differentiating between or articulating a difference between original and one of a kind. And we talk about that a lot. I play this game called In, Out, Maybe, where they have to rank artwork and objects and artifacts to determine why they think it's art or not, and then kind of put the criteria down in a list. And originality always comes up as the top of the list for many of them. But yet they can't articulate what that means. And so many times when they define original, they define it as one of a kind. But then we start arguing about, well, this is a one of a kind piece, but it's not original because it stemmed from something for which the artist has been inspired. So I love playing the devil's advocate and getting them arguing about it, you know.
Sounds like a great class.
Yeah, I want to take it. I also want to know, do you define originality at the end of the course? Because I'd like
to
know what it is.
Because I don't have the perfect definition either. But, I mean, I completely concur that I don't think anything is original anymore. And, you know, art students always think that they have the best ideas that are completely original and they should automatically get A's, right?
gravitas.
I think the fine arts in particular bear the biggest burden, right? Because after a while you have Barnett Newman and people like that doing work that then lies open to the my kid could do that accusation because they are sort of overthrowing a certain tradition of craft and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something about a subject, about the person's, I would sort of throw in also the word individuality. Like there's something about, I think when I really like a work of art, it's because I feel like there's something in the creator of it that's speaking to me that feels like it's just between me and that person. You know, there's something about it having come from the sort of deep fund of real subjectivity in the person who did it that makes me feel satisfied as a art viewer or consumer.
Let me grab a couple more calls here. Then we do have to move on, switch subjects here. Here's Christian in Portland. Hi, Christian.
Hi, how are you, Colin and Jim? A couple of things. First of all, Jim, you were thinking of Zamfir as far as the pan flute.
Thank
players.
You so much. Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's,
yeah, yeah. And also, Jim, you and I have a mutual friend who always told me, if you're going to steal from the best. And that was Big Al. Here's a quite accomplished guy who really knew what he was doing.
That's why he plays with me.
Yeah. Well, exactly. It's unclear who's stealing from whom here.
I think it's clear. I steal from him.
It's a great quote. But and last call will be from Janet in North Haven. Hi, Janet.
How are you?
Just fine.
Good. So my absolutely original and completely creative voice is Verlin Klinkenborg, who was one of the editorial board of the New York Times and who last week announced that he was retiring. And when I read it, I burst into tears, which surprised me very much. But I think in part because he always said something that was new and original and uplifting and wondrous, full of wonder for the world. And especially after reading everything else on the editorial and the op-ed page, it was just uplifting and wonderful, and I'm really sad that he's gone.
Well, it also goes to that whole question of operating within institutions, which will lead us nicely into our next segment. But so Verlin Klinkenborg, who wrote these kind of incredibly pastoral, rural, kind of farm-oriented essays on the New York Times editorial page, the real question was, how did he ever persuade them to let him do that? You know, because it's such a departure from everything else that they do. It really is. It's not their best standards and practices. It's something really, really different, which he was able to pull off for quite a long time. And some of the excitement of seeing that work is seeing it in a context where you wouldn't expect it. All right, we have to stop because we have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about something else. So every once in a while, somebody gets into trouble because of what they say, and because what they say conflicts somehow with the value system that their employers either espouse or secretly hold. So we saw this a few weeks ago on the news, talking about Phil Robertson from Duck Dynasty, who was suspended, although not for very long, and not with much conviction by A&E for some of his thoughts about gay marriage, which, as we later learned, turned out to be some of his less incendiary thoughts and more palatable thoughts compared to other thoughts that he turns out to have. However, that's not what we're going to talk about, although we may tie it into what we're talking about. The case in point this week, and his dismissal actually happened quite a long time ago, is Chris Cluey. Chris Cluey, who did not play this season for the Minnesota Vikings, where he's a punter. They wish they were in Miami. The Minnesota Vikings, where he's a punter. And Chris Cluey, just to kind of set the stage, he's been a very atypical NFL player in a lot of different ways. He comes across as very verbal, smart, literate, interested in a lot of other things. He's kind of a hero within the world of gamers in particular. He's really into video games, and he's constantly being invited to talk about video games and stuff like that. I think he's been on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me as the Not My Job guy. He's that kind of guy. He's sort of the only problem that he has now is he can't be an NFL punter who's that kind of guy because the Minnesota Vikings got rid of him. In a Deadspin this week, an online sports site, he wrote a long essay saying basically that he was gotten rid of mainly because of his outspokenness about certain things, especially gay marriage. But also at the time of the changeover in popes, he also took to Twitter to offer some of his thoughts about how the Roman Catholic Church had behaved institutionally and was told by his employers to shut up about that. And he described a situation where the special teams coach, his immediate supervisor, was actively homophobic and mean and rude about it, and that played some role, he thinks, in his downfall and his outplacement. So maybe not that unusual a story, but I don't know. Irene, what did you make of it?
Well, I was just thinking, too, that I like the way that he accused the other two guys of being cowards, you know, because it seems like that really hurts.
Head coach and the general manager, I think.
Yeah, to sort of expose people for going along with the powers that be, no matter what they thought, because that was just their job, to say, sorry, we're going to have to fire you, and then to say they're cowards, I thought that was, you know, pretty impressive.
It's certainly what made the link more viral, right? And that he called the head coach, who's actually been fired also as well as of the end of the season, and the general manager cowards.
Yeah, you know, that does sort of tie into the Duck Dynasty thing, and I'm not doing this intentionally, but it does sort of speak to that sort of tacit complicity by stifling the speech that sort of A&E said, oh, we're going to suspend this guy, and they did for 20 minutes. And I don't even think they should suspend him, but they went through the whole kabuki of doing that. And these guys were just the opposite. They just tried to stifle this guy. So they are sort of tacitly complicit in that sort of homophobic thing. But this guy gets to be a folk hero now, and
he insists on it.
Right. And so maybe that becomes his
best
new
thing
gig.
That could have happened,
you know,
to him.
Well,
yeah.
In a way, he's not going to get a concussion from that, unless it's, you know, from the guys in Duck Dynasty. I don't know. But
we're gonna go to Tracy Fastenberg in just a second. I just want to say, if you want to comment on this, if you followed this story over the course of the week, our number, 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. The world of Twitter is another option. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. I know you had to ask your husband to sort of
I did. I'm not
Chris
a football
Cluey
fan.
In context.
Exactly. So I had to ask him, you know, was he playing well? Was he actually a good punter? Or is it founded that maybe his dismissal had to do with his having these opinions?
This is the moment which, by the way, husbands just make stuff up because they know you won't be able to check.
He was actually honest. He was like, you know what, I'm not positive, but I think he was sort of average, which you confirmed. You know, but I think one of the things that kind of struck me as we talked about Duck Dynasty versus Chris Cluey is that what Chris Cluey was saying didn't necessarily go along with the persona of the NFL. You know, we already talked about that he's sort of this intellectual jack of all trades, Renaissance man, you know, has all these other interests and abilities and
I don't know if we went as far as to say intellectual.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, he's...
But this is new turf for the NFL.
NFL players are not necessarily known for being academic. Just like the young man who was bullied on, I can't remember, the Miami team?
It was the
right,
Miami
right.
team.
Hey, I remembered something about NFL.
Yeah, see,
you know, but that sort of goes against that. Whereas what the Duck Dynasty guy was sort of spewing... sort of went along with his persona and went along with what you would expect in certain ways from the portrayal of his character, whether that's truly him or not. You know, I think maybe because it contradicts what you expect from the person, that's where the issues come in a little
bit. Because it's original.
Hey.
We like people.
I think from here on in, he should be known as the people's punter because that's the title he's kind of going for. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I thought some of this rant was a lot about Chris Cluey and maybe not so much about some of the issues behind it. I mean, I applaud his stance on all these issues. And, you know, I struggle with this because, you know, for example, I mean, first of all, I think there's a lot of kabuki here in these stories, too. In the case of the Duck Dynasty, you know, A&E, the network, they knew who these guys were. They knew what they would believe. They know what they're selling. They're selling that kind of outspokenness and that kind of occasional shockingness, you know, just in the same sense that you know, all the people who got instantly horrified by Don Imus were ignoring the fact that Don Imus had done the same thing essentially every day of his career for decades and decades, and lots of very, you know, estimable people would go on the show anyway. It didn't really bother them all that much. I look at Chris Cluey, and to me it's a slightly different case. I think to me what's interesting is that the NFL is looking to broaden its reach. First of all, the NFL is having the worst year of its existence. I mean, the evidence about concussions is mounting up in a very, very disturbing way. You had also, yes, the Miami Dolphins drama, the lineman who was bullying the other lineman in very unflattering ways. Meanwhile, for the NFL to survive, it really does need to broaden its reach, have more women watch it, have more, maybe even, attract something of a gay and lesbian audience, and not be off-putting to anybody. So, you know, in a way, Chris Cluey is the kind of guy that they would sort of want. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just that
if he wasn't just the tip of the wave.
Now, right.
The question I have, I thought, does he drive a Subaru?
Well, exactly. Well, that's the difference, okay? So that links us to the final place that we'll go here. So the NFL, on the one hand, really would like to make itself very friendly and a little softer and a little bit more cuddly so that other people could embrace it. And significantly, the owner of the Vikings, first of all, on a one-to-one basis, supported the stuff that Chris Cluey was doing and is involved on his own in other organizations, including one organization that's credited with really helping New Jersey change its policies on gay marriage. So, I mean, it's not like the NFL is full of, you know, homophobic people. I mean, there are probably a lot of homophobic people who are coaching special teams and stuff like that. But institutionally, the NFL would really like to do this. It just doesn't really know how to do it without breaking with its image. So let's take a look at somebody else who did do it. There was a piece in Slate magazine this week about how did that linkage happen? How did it happen that Subarus and lesbians became linked in people's minds? And the example, the most recent example of this being sort of outwardly stated was the fabulous, wonderful Kate McKinnon on Saturday Night Live. She's pretending to be Billie Jean King. She's talking about the fact how cool she thinks it is, how she can't wait to go and be this lesbian woman in Russia to shock Putin because she's going to be part of the U.S. delegation to the Olympics there. So let's hear a little bit of Kate McKinnon.
Well, you look pretty, pretty excited to go to Sochi.
Yeah, I couldn't be more excited, Seth. I'm President Obama's big gay middle finger, and this bird's about to get flipped.
That's quite a big statement.
Yeah, you bet it is, Domino. BJK's about to double down, and Putin's gonna find himself in the epicenter of a gay tornado. I'm gonna drive my Subaru Outback into Red Square doing donuts and blasting Melissa Etheridge.
That's right. So so basically that's Billie Jean King, or really Kate McKinnon, saying something that everybody kind of knows, right? You drive a Forester.
I just got a Forester in September, and everyone from my husband to very close friends has made the lesbian joke at some point. And when the article came out on Slate, I got it from six different people.
So. Wow. We had one for 11 years, and it just kind of ran out of gas. And so I asked my wife what are the things that
you actually can put more gas in them?
You're right.
You don't have to trade them in when they run out of gas. I know they get great mileage.
Yeah, no, and they come with four dogs and a practical haircut. No, I asked my wife what she liked about it, and she said that, you know, they were romantic and dashing, and of course that was me. But yeah. She said they were it was compact, full of features, and in her case, it had the weather band. And my wife is snow phobic. And was curdled in a ball this morning, but even bought a little weather band thing for her new car, but she didn't buy another Subaru. But I think she's going to wait till she comes out. That's not true.
But what was interesting about that article was that the Slate author, I mean, traced how Subaru had really actively courted that connection. It wasn't like they waited for somebody else to make it. They wanted that connection. They were smart enough to know that's a big market, right? And it's not as though it precludes anybody else owning a Subaru. I own a Subaru. What were you going to say?
Well, I'm just wondering if, first of all, what it did to their sales, you know, and maybe I guess it must have helped them, you know. And I wonder so that goes back to the NFL story, and it makes me think about whether actually ultimately, since our country is going so far towards accepting homosexuality, if it would actually be, and maybe that's what you were implying, Colin, that it would be sort of good for the NFL, and even in terms of their audience, or is their audience so entrenched in that sort of traditional male, you know, homophobic culture that it would backfire in some way?
For me, that's a question more than an answer. I'm like, how big is the entrenched homophobic male culture? Is it big enough to sustain something that needs as much sustenance as the NFL needs to breathe? Or does the NFL need to evolve, have more Jonathan Martin, he was the bully E, type players, have more Chris Cluey type players front and center, you know, intelligent, sensitive people that you can relate to if you're not sitting in a duck blind talking about, you know, God's plan for marriage.
Yeah, those people.
It's interesting that we could actually have a conversation like this, a lesbian / Subaru conversation, and not feel like it's pejorative or in any way slanderous.
We'll check my email later.
Yeah, right. No, but I mean, I have a lot of gay women friends who make jokes about it, and just take a trip to Northampton, and it's a parking lot.
Of Subarus.
Subarus.
All right. Before I do get email, I think we're going to wrap up this conversation. We've got to leave time for endorsements, which is not an original idea, by the way. I stole endorsements from Slate Culture Gabfest. I mention that every 3 months or so nobody even suspects me of being Conan O'Brien.
This has nothing to do with what they're talking about, but when the last minutes of my life tick away, I'm going to be really annoyed that I spent 1 hour watching Hollywood Game Night. Actually, Jane Lynch is the host, so duh, there is a connection. Today's show was produced by Colin and me. Get well, Betsy Kaplan. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski, but she's sick too. And our tweetmaster, Greg Hill, is not here. And the person who was supposed to play the part of Bill Curry has a scratchy throat. Are you sensing a trend here? Super producer Lydia Brown came over from where we live and flew co-pilot today. For stories, links, photos, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff trying to punt a creme brulee, visit WNPR.org. On Monday, a PBS Frontline crew visits to tell the story of the other Wolf of Wall Street, Steve Cohen. And now, back to Colin.
So we've come to the part in our show where Irene Papoulos and Jim Chapdelaine and Tracy Wu Fastenberg and I will tell you about things that you might enjoy if you knew about them. Tracy Wu Fastenberg, you go first.
All right, I'm going to have to go ahead and endorse my Subaru Forester because as I was telling you guys, I was driving around this morning feeling very, very smug and safe in the snow because it did an amazing job.
Is it the four-wheel drive?
It is four-wheel or all-wheel drive.
All-wheel drive, yeah.
So it's always going, which is great. And then because we have made plenty of references to the fact that I'm pregnant, my favorite pregnancy blog right now is pregnantchicken.com because so many of these pregnancy sites are so like floofy and sort of flowery and everything. And this one's just sort of cynical and straight to the point and has a good sense of humor about
it. What kinds of things do they cover on a pregnancy site like Pregnant Chicken? I mean, what do you read it to get?
Just general information, but it's sort of delivered with a little snark, too, because, you know, everybody's like, oh, you're going to feel the first flutters, you know, and on this blog, it's sort of like, yeah, it's going to feel like a kid's kicking you in the gut and you're going to want to poke it back. So, you know, it's just it's sort of a different, easier way to kind of ingest all of this information.
All right. Pregnant snark. It's Pregnant Chicken. We'll check it out. Even though we're not pregnant, we all have to go look at it. All right. Go ahead, Jim.
I had hoped, this is sort of last minute after the holiday, so I had hoped. I went to a movie to escape reality, and I had hoped that I would endorse it. I went to The Hobbit, and I noticed that I came out with a beard longer than any of the characters. So it's a long movie, but I did notice this. I caught myself doing this. Like there's orcs and elves and dwarves and hobbits, and at one point, you know, an elf jumps 50 feet in the air and slays 20 orcs, I thought, that couldn't happen. And I realized, what am I doing? I'm equivocating in The Hobbit. I'm saying that. I wonder just how many people do that. So secondly, I want to thank people. I went on Facebook and I reached out for this little cureasc.org, which is a cancer I have dealt with and survived. I'm the longest survivor on the site. And in the short time that I did that, I've been able to raise $4,000. So I thank you guys. It was very moving for me.
All right. That is great. And if you find yourself really kind of fixating a lot on what the physical limitations of elves are or aren't and, you know, whether elves could accomplish certain things, Patrick Scahill can direct you to some websites where you can spend a lot of time with like-minded people.
I do it with time travel movies, too. I'm all in and then, hey, that couldn't happen. Wait a second.
All right, what have you got for us?
I also went to a movie, American Hustle, and I endorse it. The thing that I really like about David O. Russell's movies is that he talks about people that are sort of maybe odd and unusual, but not to make fun of them, to really get inside their experience in a way that I find moving and interesting.
David O. Russell, by the way, who did The Fighter, who did Silver Lining Playbook, who did a whole bunch of other movies that we've praised on this show in the past. And it's an incredible cast, too. I haven't seen it yet. I will be seeing many movies in the next 4 or 5 days because on Thursday of next week, David Edelstein will be in the studio with me. We'll be locking horns once again, as we've done so many times over the decades. So that means I have to get myself ready. And it could be also that the young upstart A.O. Scott, Tony Scott, will be joining us by phone. But I'll be seeing a lot of movies. I'm so late to all of the parties that I'm endorsing. First of all, let me do a plug, and that's for a week from Saturday, September 11th. Welcome to Bohemia. This is Greg Garcia's kind of traveling. I don't know what to call it exactly. It is, you know, it's sort of a simulated bohemian party. You walk in and there's interesting art that's been hung on the walls and there's things to eat and drink. And there are all kinds of performers in a kind of genre-defying manner doing all kinds of different stuff. And
original.
Original stuff. It really is original. It really is fun. It's the kind of thing that you probably don't think we have in Hartford, but we do. It'll be at Theater Works. It always has, it's like a hermit crab. It finds different shells. And so it'll be at Theater Works on September 11th. I think
January
11th? January. I'm having a really bad time. I actually wrote September 11th. That's really bad. January 11th. Anyway.
You should give people lead time.
Exactly. And so it starts at 7 p.m., which is way too early for anything bohemian. But it really is a lot of fun. And if you're new to town and you can tell the difference between January and September and you want to maybe go to something that will give you a different flavor for Hartford, that's a lot of fun. Okay, I'm really late to these other parties. I just finished reading Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood. But I really think it's just – Margaret Atwood is just a great writer. Anyway, she's just in that whole business of putting one word after another and one sentence after another. She's just really good at it. And this is a terrific book. It takes place in the future, very dystopian kind of future. But what it really is a dialogue. When you put the book down and you realize, you know, it's been a very gripping story. But it's also a really interesting dialogue between the sciences and the humanities, between STEM, as it were, and the often imperiled humanities. And if you don't have the ability to ask really good evaluative questions about scientific progress, you get stuck with whatever scientific progress the scientists hand you, and they may not be thinking as humanistically as you are. So it's really great. And then Sort of, I'm like Jim, this is kind of a medium recommendation, but and I'm also late to this party, but the movie Prisoners, which came out last year, which I believe was 2013. I'm trying to orient myself in time better now, but which has an incredible cast. It's Hugh Jackman. It's Jake Gyllenhaal. It's and a wonderful, wonderful supporting cast, too. A little bit of a horror movie, kind of a Hitchcockian horror movie, a little bit exploitive in some ways, but also a really interesting kind of ethical conundrum. All right, I'm being told to wrap things up. Thank you, Tracy. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Irene. I'll be back on Monday, which is not in September. It's in January. I'm absolutely sure of that.
On the radio, baby.
I'm Kyone Wolf. All right, original thought. No one can make you feel inferior without your consent. Eleanor Roosevelt. Don't find fault, find a remedy. Nah, Henry Ford. Kyone Wolf loves Rush Limbaugh. Well, that's original. It hurts.